From WNYC New York Public Radio, I'm Leonard Lopate. This is just one segment of the Leonard Lopate Show, but every interview is available on demand at WNYC.org. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC On Demand is supported by Open, how American Express serves small business. Open offers a range of products and services designed exclusively for small business. Details at 888-779-OPEN or open.com.
We've all heard stories of people cutting a loved one out of their wills or leaving everything to their dogs. And although those sorts of things are relatively rare, wills are among the most important documents we can create during our lifetimes. So we have decided to look into the matter of wills on today's Please Explain, how to make one, what to put in, what to leave out, and what can happen if you don't have one. And I'm joined now by Beverly Goodman, senior editor with Smart Money Magazine, and by Vincent J. Russo of Vincent J. Russo & Associates. They specialize in elder law and estate planning. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, Vincent, tell us about elder law. Do most people wait until they're on in years before they wind up going to you for a will?
I would say, unfortunately, the answer is yes, that most people wait until they're in crisis or about to go into crisis, or if they're younger, they're about to take a family vacation, and all of a sudden it pops up in their mind that they really should have a will in place, and they simply don't have one.
Now, you don't just do wills. You also do trusts, living wills, living trusts. Should they all be done, in your estimation, when people are young?
Absolutely. Once you reach legal age of majority, age 18, there are steps that every individual should take to protect themselves, starting with a durable power of attorney and a health care proxy and a living will, so that if you're in a car accident, for example, financial and health care decisions can be made for you.
Beverly, in its simplest form, what is a will?
In its simplest form, and they can be extraordinarily simple, it's really just a list of your property and how you want it to be distributed once you pass.
But for some people, that would not be really a big problem. Isn't it more of a concern when there is a spouse and their children and other people who you would want the money to be passed on to?
That's when it becomes vital, I would say. But there are good reasons for making a will, even if you're relatively young and maybe don't have a lot of investments, or even if you don't own a home. It's not only about how you want your property distributed. It's also what you think your heirs might find of value.
So it doesn't have to be, as you say, property. Some people don't own property, and they don't really have much of significance to pass on.
Right. Well, I mean, property can be real estate, but it's also anything you own. And obviously, after a death of a loved one, tensions are running high. People are very emotional. And you'd be surprised the conflict that can arise over a photo album or, you know, a bunch of souvenirs from a vacation that was really well-loved. And that's a will is an easy way of just sort of making sure that the family kind of all knows what to do in what's a very emotional time.
Do you have any idea of how many of us don't have wills?
I don't know the percentage, but I will say far too many of us don't have wills.
Vincent, do you know?
Well, statistically, they say that more than half of the population do not have wills.
Mm. So that's a lot of people.
Yeah.
For those of us who are overwhelmed by the idea, for whatever reason, what goes into having a will made? Can I just write a thing on a paper napkin? Would that suffice as a will?
Well, the answer would be no. A will is a legal document, and depending on what state you live in, you need to follow the laws of that state in order to make that document valid under the state law. So in New York, for example, in order for a will to be valid, it has to be signed in front of two witnesses. And without the two witnesses, that will would not be valid.
So even if I don't have a lawyer, if I have two people who are watching me write out this will and then sign it, that's okay?
Well, it's okay as long as you follow all the formalities for a proper will execution. It's okay if, as long as that will covers all of the issues and areas of concern that you have, and it's clearly stated. So that I'm going to say that for most people, to draft their own will would be a mistake, because you want to make sure that this will is going to hold up after you pass away, that it's going to be valid, that the executor that you want to appoint is going to be approved by the court to manage your estate. You want the assets to go clearly to the people you designate in the will. Lawyers can add value in how a will is drafted simply by our experiences. We always want to provide for contingencies. So, for example, it would be important to have a backup executor named in the document. For example, if you leave your assets to your children, what happens if a child predeceases you? Then where do the assets go?
Well, of course, you're a lawyer, and you lawyers always say that we should go to lawyers when we do any legal documents. But are there computer programs that would allow me to do this? Can I go into a stationery store and buy a will?
In today's world, there are a number of online services that provide forms of wills for the consumers. And there are stationary type forms that can be purchased. And I think it's important to think of this more than simply a form that you're filling out, because one size does not fit all. And a form that is general in nature may not address the kinds of things that you would like to put in the document, and it may not address the kinds of contingencies or concerns for your loved ones that you're leaving assets for.
What about those witnesses? If I had two witnesses and one of them was a beneficiary, would that will still be legal?
That would be a problem.
Because people might see some kind of coercion involved?
Well, you cannot have as witnesses anyone who benefits directly under the will.
Now, Beverly, you have a theory as to why people find it so hard to to make a will, despite all of the reasons we know we should have one.
Right. Well, the popular theory is certainly that people don't like to talk about death or don't like to think about death.
Picasso said that's the reason he wouldn't write a will.
Exactly. However, my theory is that even worse than thinking and talking about death, people really hate talking about money. And creating a will means you need to know a fair amount about your financial situation, which is a terrifying prospect for a lot of people. And in my experience, I've found, regardless of net worth, the more organized a person is about how they approach their finances, the more likely they are to have a will. And the more disorganized or possibly in debt or just with various emotional issues tied to money, those are the folks that really shy away from making wills.
Well, if I don't have a will and I die, wouldn't my estate go automatically to certain people who are expected to receive the money? If I have a spouse, it would go to a spouse. If I have children, it would go to children.
That's true, but it's still problematic. If you have a spouse, it will go to your spouse, but perhaps more of it will go to your spouse than you even want. If you have children from a previous marriage and you haven't been married very long, maybe you want more of your estate to go directly to your children. And in many states, there's a minimum. It's usually one-third to one-half as to what, you know, a spouse deserves. And there's also a problem with leaving to your children. It sounds sort of obvious. Well, why wouldn't I want my children to inherit my wealth? But if they're young and there's no custodian appointed for their inheritance, whoever their guardian is probably going to have to petition the court every time they want to spend money on the child's behalf. no matter how obviously legitimate the reason may be, whether it's Little League or college tuition. And that's a huge hassle that you really don't want to set up.
My guests are Beverly Goodman, senior editor with Smart Money Magazine, and Vincent J. Russo of Vincent J. Russo & Associates. And this is Please Explain on the Leonard Lopate Show on WNYC and WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Could some of these problems be resolved, Vincent, by a prenuptial agreement? Let's say a couple is getting married and there are children, as Beverly pointed out, from a previous marriage. And maybe the person with more money doesn't want it all to go, half of it to go to the new spouse who doesn't really need it.
Yeah, a prenuptial agreement is a good way of having in place a plan as assets are distributed out in a marital situation, a second marriage, for example, and we want to outline clearly who would be entitled to those assets or not entitled to them if one passes away. Most states have a law which provides that the spouse has a right to a certain portion of your estate, and you can agree to give up that right in a marital agreement. Notwithstanding, it really doesn't go to the heart of the bigger picture, which is you still need to have a plan in place for the distribution of those assets to other people. And so a will allows you to control who will inherit your assets, when they will inherit them, and also a will is revocable. That's very important. It should give some peace and comfort to someone knowing that what they feel and believe today in terms of leaving assets on their demise can be changed in the future. A prenuptial agreement, for example, is a contract that is going to bind both parties unless they both agree to modify it.
Have you had any really wild or problematical wills proposed?
Sure. Lots of situations where wills can become very complicated, or people can have desires and interests stated in wills that could be, a little to the left or the right of the mainstream. For example, in New York, we have what we call the New York Pet Trust Law. And so you can leave money to your favorite dog or cat in a trust, and you can do that under a will. And so in one case, I spent a significant amount of time outlining how the money was going to be used for the client's cats that she had, and what would happen at the end when the cats passed away, and helping not-for-profit organizations that support the care of animals. So it was a fairly elaborate plan for a client who had no immediate family but was very concerned about her pets. I've had clients in their wills talk about cryogenics. I had one case where the client was setting aside insurance money so that his body would be frozen at death with the hope that once they found the cure to his disease that killed him, that they would be able to bring him back to life. How's that one for a wild one?
Well, it doesn't surprise me. I've heard of cases like this. In fact, there are big fights over whether people there was one recently where a head was severed and yes. Then frozen. So it can get pretty gruesome, I imagine. Yeah. Beverly, some years ago there was a best-selling book about avoiding probate. Why would we want to avoid probate?
There are a lot of reasons to avoid probate, although it's not as frightening as it may sound.
Well, first of all, what is probate?
Probate is a fairly straightforward court process that looks at your will. It validates your will. It appoints an executor if your will does not. It enables someone to take inventory of your property and then disseminate it according to the will. If there is no will, the judge, again, appoints someone to do all that, pay the debts, that sort of thing, and then goes about figuring out how best to apportion the assets. The reason to avoid it, though, is it can be very time-consuming. It can take 6 months to a year to work its way through the court process. And it's also fairly costly. It can be 3 to 5% of your estate. And since there are so many fairly simple ways of avoiding probate, why not save that money?
Vincent, a listener asks if the executor of a will can also be a beneficiary.
The executor of a will can also be a beneficiary under a will. There's no problem with that.
Uh-huh. But it has to be clearly spelled out how that works. The executor is the person you name to take care of all of the different aspects of the will?
Right. The executor is the person you're appointing to administrate your estate. And what that simply means is that it's authorizing the executor to pay any debts that you have when you pass away, or any expenses, any taxes to the government that may be owed, be it income taxes or estate taxes. They're responsible to collect all the assets that you have and then distribute them to the appropriate parties, beneficiaries named under the will. So that would pertain to personal property like furniture and the photographs that Beverly mentioned and the like. It would also pertain to assets that may be bank accounts, real property such as your home. It could be stocks and bonds that are held in a brokerage account. And often wills provide for assets to be distributed into a trust under the will or to a trust that's already been established. And so the executor would be responsible for making sure that those assets are transferred in the appropriate way.
Sometimes people control their heirs through the executor. I remember some friends who where he died, and he kept his wife and his daughter on the dole, in effect, through the executor. He would not allow them to control their own money, even though they were both mature women.
Yeah, and there may have been a good reason or a very bad reason.
It sounded, in this case, I think it was a bad reason, but yeah. Does a lawyer say, I'm not sure you should keep infantilize these people, or do you just simply say, okay, well, if that's what you want, then that's what I'll write up?
Well, we work for our client, and so our client tells us what they would like to do when we draft the will. And then we explain to them the consequences of those kinds of instructions, you know, the pros and the cons. And so we try to enlighten and educate our clients, and then they can make an informed decision, just like you would with a doctor on a medical decision.
My guests are Vincent J. Russo, Vincent J. Russo and Associates, and Beverly Goodman, senior editor with Smart Money Magazine. Our number here is 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC. We'll take a little break, and when we come back, we'll take your calls and also address the whole issue of trusts, because I know a lot of calls are coming in already with people who have questions about trusts. We're back with Please Explain, and my guests are Vincent J. Russo of Vincent J. Russo and Associates. They specialize in elder law and estate planning. And with Beverly Goodman, who's a senior editor at Smart Money Magazine, we are taking your calls at 212-433-9692. And Edward from Manhattan, you're on the air.
Hi. I had a friend die and left, I don't remember if the word was in trust to or in trust for. At any rate, I had no problems with transferring and taking charge of his accounts, you know, savings and checking accounts. And I'm wondering what the difference or how that works, because I just closed them down as soon as I paid his bills and everything, you know.
Vincent?
Yes. What you're referring to is a bank account that is titled in the name of the person who owns the account in trust for another person. And under that type of bank account, when the bank account owner passes away, it automatically then is able to pass to the person named in trust for. So it is a convenient way of passing an asset on to another person without probate. The only concern would be that if someone has assets beyond just a single bank account, then they really want to deal with all of their assets, and the best way to do that would be with a will. But if you want to leave a particular asset to a particular person, an in-trust for account is one of the ways that you can accomplish that.
Which may be a good holding action for younger people or people who haven't amassed the necessary fortune.
Yeah, but my concern is that we often think in terms of wills and assets. And wills do more than just deal with assets. For that younger person, if they're married, they may have minor children. And you want to make sure that you're appointing a guardian under your will who would be the person who would then take care of your child if something happened to you. So there are other examples I could give where a will goes beyond just the passing of an asset.
That's absolutely true, but and while none of this obviates the need for a will, there are a lot of very easy ways to avoid probate, which means your heirs get your money a lot faster and a lot easier. And one of them is, as you mentioned, to name a beneficiary on a bank account. Every IRA, 401k brokerage account that you could have has a beneficiary listing. You should absolutely do that, and all of that money would avoid probate. And the same goes for jointly owning anything, whether it's a car or an apartment, a piece of real estate. If you have a joint tenancy with another person, they will then become the sole owner of that property at your death.
What about trusts? Most people, I think, see trusts as, for the very wealthy, a way to avoid estate taxes. Are there trusts that people of more modest means might benefit from?
Sure. It's really a changing world that we're in, and trusts are now a very useful document and planning technique for people of modest means in a number of areas. For example, with the elderly, you could set up a trust as a way of protecting assets in the event you need long-term care, which can be so costly. Trusts can be set up to protect assets for a beneficiary who has creditor problems. Trusts are being used to protect assets for a child with special needs. So if there's a parents have a child with autism, they now could leave assets in what's called a supplemental needs trust for their child.
Because the child will outlive them. The child will outlive them, and there are no ways of ensuring that that child will be taken care of when he's 30 or 40 years old.
Yeah, so a trust is a way of putting someone in charge of managing the assets and then utilizing those monies for the care of someone with special needs.
Let's take some more calls. Our number is 212-433-9692. Dave from Bronxville. Hi, you're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. Beverly Goodman mentioned the costs of probate are 3-5%. Is that a court fee, or is that the attorney's fee, or where does that money end up?
It's a combination. There are lawyers involved, even if they're not your lawyers, and even if it's not contested. So it's a combination of the court fees and the lawyers that are processing, and as well as, you know, as any time you pay a lawyer, you're paying for their assistance work also. There's a fair amount of paperwork that's generated.
I see. Is there any way to do it on a fixed hourly basis or something like that?
I'm not sure. I don't believe so, but these are all very state-specific laws, so you can look into it. Very small estates can pass through probate very quickly. If you own your home, you probably have too large an estate for that, but you know, if you have limited investments and don't own your home, then there's a chance it could sail through and would cost far less than that.
Vincent?
Thank you. One point I would make in terms of clarification is that often people confuse the total cost of an estate administration as the same as the cost of probate. Here in New York, probate generally would be less than 3% of an estate for sure. But the entire estate administration could end up with a fee in the 3% range. We've seen an evolution here. In the past, attorneys used to charge one executor's commission, which was the rate set by the courts, what an executor would be paid as the legal fee. And we have found that through the years that that fee's been too high. It's been higher than what it should be for the services being rendered. So we've seen the fees being relevant to how much time is spent. So lawyers are charging on an hourly basis, or they're charging a lesser percentage than the executor's commission. And as Beverly said, there are ways of keeping the cost down, and avoiding probate obviously would keep the overall cost of an estate administration down.
Beverly, I want to return to something that Vincent talked about. In his case, he was talking about somebody with an autistic child. But what about matters of guardianship, whether the child is autistic or not? Is that something that a will resolve?
Absolutely. And I can't imagine a more important reason for having a will than naming a custodian for your child. And as I mentioned earlier, also naming a custodian for the money that you trust, someone that you trust to manage.
Well, the child reaches majority, you'd want to make sure that the kid doesn't wind up with foster parents or whatever. And then you can also take care of the child into adulthood through dealing with doling out the money, in effect?
Exactly. And those can be two different people. Whoever you want to be the guardian of your child, who will best raise them and take them into their home, that's not necessarily the person that you need to have administer your estate. It's often a good idea, but it's often not. Families are very complicated, and there's no rule of thumb for that.
But a ward of state is a possibility if you don't have a will?
Well, if you die without a will and without appointing a guardian for your child, the court will appoint someone. The chances are very slim that they'll end up in foster care, but the court may appoint someone that you're not necessarily is the best person.
Cousin Mary, you never liked her.
Well, they would probably give it to your parents first, but maybe your parents are elderly, or maybe they live in another state. Maybe you have a affluent brother that lives far and might be able to provide a really good home for them and makes a really good case, but you'd rather they go with your sister who has other kids the same age as your kids and lives nearby. You know, you need to make that decision. You can't have the court do it for you.
Or a divorced spouse who you think would make a lousy parent.
Exactly. Or a divorced spouse that you think would make a good parent. That's often when people award guardianship, but they don't want their ex-husband or ex-wife to manage the money for the kids. So that's one example of when you might separate the two jobs.
Karen from Astoria, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. My question has to do with trusts and a generation skipping trust. Because I was told that something's happening in 2009 where there's going to be like a open window where the estate taxes don't apply?
It's 2010. There's a one-year repeal of the estate tax. And then in 2011, it goes back to having a $1 million exemption.
So I've heard that under that law, it may be best for all very wealthy people to die in the year 2010.
If you can arrange it, yeah, that would be optimal for very wealthy people.
Suggested by my grandmother's attorney.
Yeah, on the question of the generation skipping, you're referring to a planning technique where an individual could leave, like a grandparent, could leave money for grandchildren. Thus, if they avoiding potential estate tax on those assets if they were passed into the child's estate. So you got the grandparent who could leave it to a child. When the grandparent dies, there could be a tax because of the size of the estate. Right now, if it was over $2 million. And then if the assets went to the child and then the child passed away, there'd be a second tax, estate tax possibly. And then ultimately the grandchild would inherit and it would really be diluted what they would receive. With generation skipping, and there are limits on how much you can skip, but with generation skipping you could bypass the second generation and allow assets to pass to the third generation, grandparent to grandchild, with avoiding that potential second tax in the middle.
Thank you for your call. Samuel from New York. Hi, you're on. Please explain. Samuel, are you there? Turn up the radio. Okay, well, I'm going to move on to another caller. Lisa, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, I was hoping that everyone could talk about same-sex planning and estate issues.
That's actually something I wanted to get to earlier in terms of the importance of a will. It's absolutely crucial that if you are in a committed long-term relationship that you're not married and you don't live in a state that allows civil unions, you absolutely need a will because that person will have absolutely no legal rights. And it's not actually a same-sex issue. The same is true if a heterosexual couple decides to spend their lives together without actually getting married.
Okay. Thank you for your call. We're back to Samuel. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. If there's no will, which court in New York City does one go to have the assets distributed?
In New York City, it would be the same throughout the state, you would go to the surrogate's court if there is no will, and you would commence an estate administration proceeding in the surrogate's court. So in New York City, that's down on Center Street, downtown.
Thank you for your call. John from Brooklyn, hi, you're on. Please explain.
Yes, hello, thank you. I'm wondering if inheritors of a house cannot possibly agree on how it should be disposed of, who would be able to make the decision? Would it be an estate lawyer or what?
Well, if a house passed, let's say, from a parent to three children, and the three children cannot agree on what should be done with the house, whether it be sold or rented,
yes,
and or the like, then the first step is trying to get to a resolution. And it might be helpful for an attorney to get involved to try to sit down with the three children and try to understand what the issues are and try to help get to a resolution that's acceptable to everybody. Ultimately, if the family cannot agree on what to do and you're all owners of the house, then the courts are where you're going to have to go for that resolution, and you're going to have to bring it into court, what's called a partition proceeding, or in which you would be claiming your interest in the house, and that would kind of force the issue on whether the house is sold or not sold.
It's a good time to mention that wills should not be made in secret, and a lot can be accomplished and a lot can be avoided by having discussions with your family as you're making the will to, you know, let your children know that you're leaving the house to all three of them or however many. And, you know, it helps kind of get people in the right frame of mind, start thinking ahead of time as to what they'd like done and, you know, what their options are. And it goes a long way to helping make things a little more amicable.
Although we did get an email from somebody who wants to know where's the best place to hide a will if you don't want everyone to know what's in it.
Okay,
and there are situations where that's possible.
Well, I would say the question is how to keep a will in a safe way or a safe place, because it is important for it to be safe. You need to have that document at the time one passes away in order for it to be submitted to the court for a probate or for approval of its validity. And so often if a lawyer is involved, the lawyer will typically hold an original in the lawyer's fireproof firm safe, or if the client is going to hold the will, we would recommend that they hold it either in a safe deposit box at a bank with other people named on the account so they could access it if that individual passed away, or if they do have it in a safe in their own home, they really need to communicate with another family member as to what they've done and how to access that safe so we can get to it in a timely and efficient way.
Well, along these lines, a listener writes, in my family there's a divorce and some mistrust between the second wife and the children, and this is not an uncommon situation. Is it recommended that a parent explain the basic outline of what's going where so that they know beforehand?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with Beverly that communication is key so that families don't fall apart after someone passes away because of misunderstandings or lack of understanding what one wanted. And I think in a case like that, it's really critical that the parent discuss with the children what their intentions are to try to minimize those later problems.
And Vincent's right. In a case like that, it's absolutely critical. But I think there's a lot to be gained from just letting people know what your thoughts are and what you're doing, even if it's not out of the ordinary, just letting your siblings know that you've also included a childhood friend in your will.
Now, we have very little time, but I want to get Elena in here. Elena, can you ask the question very quickly? I guess because we're on delay and people are not staying on their phone, I think Elena wanted to know more about special needs trusts, but that's perhaps too complicated for adult children. That may be a bit more complicated than we'd be able to answer in about a minute. Do you have any advice that you can give us very quickly, Vincent?
On special needs?
Yes, trust? Adult children.
Yeah, well, special needs trusts really are a wonderful way of protecting assets without losing government benefits such as Medicaid to pay for care or for supplemental security income to have a monthly income. So if someone's under 65 and disabled, they really should check into the establishment of a special needs trust.
I want to thank you both so much for participating in today's show. By the way, if we have a lot of questions that are coming in. Are there places people can go with their questions following up on the show?
They're welcome to write into Smart Money Magazine or check smartmoney.com.
And Beverly Goodman is the senior editor with Smart Money Magazine. Vincent J. Russo is obviously the Vincent J. Russo of Vincent J. Russo and Associates, which specializes
in
elder law and estate.
They can directly to our website, and they can email us with any questions.
Thank you so much. Have a great weekend, and we hope you'll join us again on Monday when political consultant Dr. Frank Luntz explains how words and phrases influence our decisions on what to buy, what to believe in, and who to vote for. And then Jake Halpern on why America's so obsessed with celebrities, and director Bill Condon talks about his latest film, Dreamgirls. By the way, if you've missed something on the show or just want to hear something again, you can listen to archives of past programs at WNYC.org. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Sarah English, Brenna Farrell, and Blake Neshek. Melissa Egan is the executive producer. We had help today from Jennifer Keeney-Sendro and contributing producer Bonnie LaFave. Debbie Daughtry is at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. Thanks for listening. Thanks for listening to The Leonard Lopate Show from WNYC, New York Public Radio. You can hear everything we do and check out our other programs on demand at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.